From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the director of Platoon and Born on the 4th of July tells us about his own experiences in Vietnam. Oliver Stone also gives us a preview of the film he's working on now about Jim Morrison and the Doors. Also today, a talk with one of the first black filmmakers to make an impact on Hollywood, Melvin Van Peebles. And book critic John Leonard reviews two new mystery novels by writers Tony Hillerman and Andrew Vox. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. The so-called 2+4 talks have concluded in Paris on an optimistic note. The BBC's Mark Brain reports the gathering's final achievements promise a prompt unification of Germany, as well as a resolution to the Polish-German border question.
The final shape of an internationally binding agreement on German unity has come rather quicker than most had expected, given sudden and dramatic impetus by Mr. Gorbachev's acceptance at his weekend talks with Chancellor Kohl of the new Germany's sovereign right to choose its security alliances, in other words, to stay in NATO. The delicate and at times hotly disputed issue of the Polish-German border has also been resolved here in Paris, with the six foreign ministers joined for the first time by their Polish counterpart, Mr. Krzysztof Skubiszewski. What the Poles and Germans have agreed is that there'll be a state treaty between them as soon as possible after unification, guaranteeing the existing border under international law and renouncing all German claims to its former eastern territories now in Poland.
The BBC's Mark Brain reporting from Paris. President Bush telephoned both Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl this morning to congratulate them for reaching an agreement that will allow a unified Germany to join the NATO alliance. The two announced the breakthrough at the end of 2 days of talks in the Soviet Union yesterday. Speaking to magazine publishers, Mr. Bush also congratulated Gorbachev for surviving his biggest political test last week.
As a politician, commended President Gorbachev and the outcome of the party Congress over there. You talk about a guy getting hit from all sides. I mean, I felt totally relaxed about what's happening in this country.
During their 40-minute telephone conversation with the Soviet leader, the president briefed Gorbachev on the economic summit in Houston and on the NATO summit in London that preceded it. A vote in the House is set for today on a proposed constitutional amendment to require a balanced budget. Debate on the measure is continuing, but before it began, House Speaker Tom Foley said he thinks the amendment will be rejected. A constitutional amendment needs a two-thirds majority to pass. Supporters said yesterday they were 18 votes short, but believe they could convince enough members who are undecided to win. If approved, the amendment would also need a two-thirds majority in the Senate and ratification by 38 of the states before it would become part of the Constitution. Scientists say they're developing a procedure which could become the first laboratory diagnostic test for Alzheimer's disease. At the second international conference on Alzheimer's in Toronto, Dr. Khalid Iqbal said several chemical trials will be carried out in the next few months, and if they show the method is accurate, the test could be used within 5 years. More than 700 doctors and scientists are attending the Toronto conference. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 0.50 points at 3,000.25 and trading of 173 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 1986 movie Platoon is generally regarded as the film that best conveyed what it felt like to be a grunt in Vietnam. Although the film was enough to discourage anyone from fighting a jungle war, the movie's writer and director, Oliver Stone, enlisted and asked to fight in Vietnam back in 1967. He won a Purple Heart. Stone drew on his Vietnam experiences again to direct Born on the 4th of July, the story of veteran Ron Kovic. Stone also co-wrote and directed Salvador, Wall Street, and Talk Radio. He wrote the screenplays for Midnight Express, Conan the Barbarian, and Scarface. Stone is completing a new film called The Doors, about the 60s rock group, their drugged-out music, and their leader, the late Jim Morrison. Stone expects the film to be released next spring.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try.
Yeah, we just finished about 2 weeks ago in mid-June.
Finished shooting it, or finished
Paris.
Editing it too?
No, finished shooting. I had a whirlwind last couple of weeks. We're shooting like 20-hour days in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York. Then we moved over to Paris and shot some stuff there, and completely exhausted, and starting to edit the film. And we'll probably be, it's going to be a big editing job. It's about 25 songs. It's a huge movie, 500,000 feet. I think it's going to take a lot of special effects, actually. We did
Are these tripping special effects?
Tripping special effects.
Really?
And yeah, we're trying to play with colors and perception, the concept of, you know, psychological perception, how that changes, not just with tripping, but with, you know, with life itself, you know, the way things darken and lighten and shift in your consciousness. So it's a film very much about expansion of consciousness. You know, Jim was always after that. He was always trying to get through the barriers, trying to break through the limits of life.
What did Jim Morrison mean to you?
Well, pretty much that, you know, that he was for a PR phrase, I'd say, you know, an avatar of consciousness, you know, somebody who was, the theme of his life would be break on through to the other side, which is his anthem song, you know. He pushed things sexually, chemically, philosophically, poetry. I think success for him itself was a limitation. I think that the ultimate trip for him, I mean, I use the 60s word, the ultimate limitation, the last place to go, the last frontier for him was death. And I think that, you know, if you look at the poetry and the songs, death is mentioned frequently. He was half in love with death, as were the great romantic poets of the 19th century. And I think that was one of his visiting spots, one of his destinations.
What phase of your life are the Doors records associated with? Is it Vietnam? Is it being home afterwards?
I'd say a combination of 67, definitely 60s, late 67 in Vietnam, turning on to it with black guys, you know, listening to it and smoking marijuana, taking acid, and R&R trips down to Australia, then going over to back to the States. And there was a run there about 68, 69. They were very much, I was big fans of Jim and the Doors. And then, you know, they were never that popular, actually, you know, in the States. I never found them to be huge the way they were but they've stayed in the consciousness, and in some ways they've become more popular after Jim's death. I talk to speak to a lot of 17, 18-year-olds that have heard the music and are very much with it.
What are you doing for a period feel in the film?
Oh, we hit all the bases we have to, you know. It's amazing in 20 years what happens. I mean, I thought it would be relatively simple to shoot, but everything was a pain in the ass. I mean, every street you take over, mailboxes, cars, the clothing, the makeup on the women, for example. I was going crazy waiting for the women extras to come out, and they'd say, well, they got to put more makeup on. And then I'd cast these beautiful young women, and they'd go into makeup, and they'd come out looking horrible. And I said, you know, something's wrong here. It's like, they said, no, this is the way the women were. They were very made up and a little bit overdressed. I mean, I don't think the styles were particularly flattering. But as I remember, they were breakthrough styles back then. They were colorful people. You know, people never had dressed that way. It was a great moment in the film. We were in San Francisco shooting Haight-Ashbury. And we set up one whole sidewalk. Signage, all the streets had to be changed, the shops. And we had 500 extras in wonderful yellows and reds and blues walking down the street, and all hippies and stuff. And I looked across the street on the other side, and there were all the tourists that come and were looking. And they were all gray and black and dark in clothing. And I said, I should take my camera now, like a Godard movie, and you pan from all the hippies in the 60s. You swing across the street for about two beats, and you see like the 90s looking at the 60s, and then you go back across the street to the 60s. That would have been a great moment in the movie. I never did it, though.
Is there a character in the film who's your surrogate?
My surrogate? No. Who would that be? You mean?
I don't know. The Oliver Stone character.
Jim. Yeah. The character... I identified with him in a lot of ways. I would have liked to have led that kind of life where you're breaking on through and testing things all the time. I do in my own way. I respect him as a writer, and I think he wanted to be a director of films when if he had lived. He always talked about going back to filmmaking. He was a UCLA film student before he became a rock musician.
Are you using Doors records in the movie, or are the actors actually doing the singing?
No, we're going to be, we have 25 to 30 songs in the movie, and it'll be a blend of mostly Doors music, but we're going to have some new elements that are going to be introduced. Because Val's a good singer, too, so he can, he's a lot of that live, he did all his concerts live. He's not lip-syncing. It's really his voice.
So you're using some music from the records and some from the actors.
And where Val is not up to Jim's standards because it was a live performance, and we'll slip Jim in. So it's going to be Jim had a great voice, and I don't want to lose that. But Val is good.
Director and screenwriter Oliver Stone is my guest. And his new film is on The Doors, and that film, The Doors, is going to open in 1991. He also made Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, Wall Street, Salvador. I rented a video of Platoon the other night because I wanted to watch some of it again before talking to you.
And talk radio, you forgot.
Oh, and talk radio, of course, yeah.
Life and death of a DJ.
Yes. So I rented a video of Platoon the other night so I could watch some of it again before talking to you. And it surprised me that before the film opens, there's Lee Iacocca standing in front of a Jeep and saying, this Jeep is a museum piece, a relic of war. And he says, I hope we will never have to build another Jeep for war. Then he talks about the soldiers and says, they were called and they went. That, in the truest sense, is the spirit of America. And then a Jeep Eagle logo comes on. Then there's a pause, and then your film starts. And I was wondering about what you thought of that kind of...
Were those the words actually were? Those
yeah,
are the
I'm
words
quoting,
you...
yeah.
Okay. I remember it being an issue. We went through the copy on it, the first copy.
So you had to give your approval.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I had to give my approval on it, and it was involved... the first copy I found to be difficult. It was too... It embraced the Vietnam War in a way that I thought was not correct and not truthful. I think we settled on this copy as a compromise. I had mixed feelings about it. It was a heavy commercial decision for Hemdale, which is a small company. They had put up the money on the film, and they needed the backing for the video, and I didn't want to be the bad guy, and I didn't think it was an offensive message. To be honest, I admired Iacocca for having turned around Chrysler, although he's since gotten into some problems, I gather. But I admire his can-do spirit.
This is the first time I can remember seeing a commercial on a video where the commercial, its message tied into the message of the film.
I remember the original copy of the message was only about American boys, and I think that I told them that no, it would have to recognize the Vietnamese deaths and at least explore the concept that the other side had suffered too. So we went around on that, Madison Avenue guys.
Right, right. The main character in Platoon drops out of college, and his analytical reason that he gives one of the soldiers who thinks that, he's crazy for being this middle class kid in the war. So the reason the Charlie Sheen character gives is, why should only the poor people fight? What was your reason for enlisting?
Well, that was part of it. I felt a sense of that it was a wrong, the war was somehow wrongly fought. If you could go to college to escape it, that if a war should be a democratic country, supposedly, therefore it should be fought along democratic principles. That means everybody goes, including senators' sons and the bankers' sons. And I think that very deeply bothered my sense of idealism about this country. And I did feel an obligation that I had to serve. I left Yale University, and there were other reasons, too. It wasn't just a sense of idealism. And there was personally, I did feel I wanted to see the war. I wanted to see war as a concept because I'd read about it in books and Hemingway and... I have to admit, it had a romantic appeal to me, and I knew it was going to be the last war of my generation, and I wanted to be there. I wanted to be part of the passion and peril of our times, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said,
How soon did it lose that romantic appeal?
First day in the bush, I cut point, I think, in the 25th, they put up the new guys right up, like in the movie, And I think I lost that sense of, you know, it was pretty, it was clear to me in the first few days that the guys there were not really fighting for an objective or with any kind of morale. They were fighting just to count the days until they left. So everybody in the unit would have, I got 85 days to go, I got 165 days to go. You know, everybody would talk about the days left, which is not the right way to, you know, to really fight a war.
Your father was a stockbroker. You'd gone to prep school in Yale. Were your parents pleased that you had enlisted? Is that what they wanted for you?
No, they were horrified. Dad was a big believer in fighting communism, and until they took his own son, you know, he didn't. No, they thought I should stay in college. I was crazy to give that up.
Was there an element of rebellion against your parents,
of course,
in the act of enlisting?
That was probably the third part of the whole thing. Was that it was something that they didn't want me to do, therefore I had to do it because. To be honest, I'd had it with my parents. You know, I'd had it with that whole way of life. Something was wrong in the American system, that as I had been educated to, and I think I was turning my back on the world as I knew it. I knew that it was, I didn't know what else there was, but I knew what I didn't want, which was to become some version of what my father was. Since then, I've grown to respect him enormously for what he's done, mm-hmm. and to see the things he went through. And understand better, but at that time I was pretty angry.
Were you a physical person, and did you feel like that you could handle yourself well physically when you got to Vietnam?
I thought I could. Yeah, I was a good athlete, and I did learn ultimately. At first, I don't think anybody's a great soldier right off the bat. I mean, combat conditions are so intense and unplanned for that you never can tell what's going to happen. And I got shot the first time in a major, in my first night ambush, I got shot, and then I got shot a second time. After that, I got pretty smart in a bush, and I started to, I could move well without being hurt. I was carrying a lot of weight. I would carry 60, 70 pounds, or sometimes less. And, you know, but there was no question that the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, were probably the best light infantry, you know, up to that time. I mean, there were great soldiers, too. And I'm not saying we were bad. I think that we did a good job, but we were up against people that we could travel very light, you know, eat rice and didn't need hot baths or showers and didn't need hot food. You know, they lived close to the ground. We had too much. In Vietnam, we had too many support troops. It was 6 or 7 to 1. You know, we had too much rear echelon. I think the war, if assuming that it was going to be fought, and I don't think it should have, but it should have been fought more in a commando-style way, Israeli army kind of way.
Screenwriter and director Oliver Stone is my guest. His movies include Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, Wall Street, and Salvador. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter and director Oliver Stone is my guest. This is a scene from his movie Platoon, which was based on his own experiences in Vietnam. Charlie Sheen plays a soldier who just arrived in Vietnam. This is a letter to his grandmother.
Somebody once wrote, "Hell is the impossibility of reason." That's what this place feels like, hell. I hate it already, and it's only been a week. The hardest thing I think I've ever done is go on point 3 times this week. I don't even know what I'm doing. A gook could be standing 3 feet in front of me and I wouldn't know it. I'm so tired. We get up at 5 a.m., hump all day, camp around 4 or 5, dig a foxhole, eat, and put out an all-night ambush or a 3-man listening post in the jungle. It's scary because nobody tells me how to do anything because I'm new. Nobody cares about the new guys. They don't even want to know your name. The unwritten rule is a new guy's life isn't worth as much because he hasn't put his time in yet. And they say if you're going to get killed in the Nam, it's better to get it in the first few weeks. The logic being, you don't suffer that much. If you're lucky, you get to stay in the perimeter at night. And then you pull a 3-hour guard shift. So maybe you sleep 3-4 hours a night. But you don't really sleep.
What was the feeling about being in a jungle war that you most wanted to communicate in Platoon?
Point of view, the subjectivity, the sense of fear and chaos that you could understand what war really is, the confusion, the fact that maybe 20% of what happens in the people who get killed in a war get killed by their own friendly fire, the sense of fear and panic, and heroism too. There's daily acts of heroism. There's a bonding between the men. There was very much a split in Vietnam that I noticed. I was in four different platoons. I was in the 1st Cav and the 25th. And in all platoons, there was like a mini civil war going on. There was sort of the people that kind of believed in it, and the lifers, and then the people that, you know, were just draftees. There was the guys who smoked a little pot, and there were guys who drank too much. There was guys who liked Smokey Robinson. There was guys who liked country music. But there was generally a political split, you know. There was a certain element of racism, very strong racism towards the Orientals from portions of the platoon, you know, that they were less than human. And a lot of the other guys were more tolerant and humanitarian. So I found that interesting. I kind of thought that it reflected, in some ways, the split I saw in the United States when I went back to the country.
The kind of confusion that you're talking about in the middle of a jungle war, you captured that both in Platoon and in Born on the 4th of July. Can you talk a little bit about choreographing a scene so that what you get watching it is the sense of confusion of not knowing, not being able to see, not knowing whose fire you're in the middle of or who you're firing at. But from your perspective as a director, everything has to be completely controlled to communicate that confusion.
Well, it's very important to show that confusion. Very important. You do not see the enemy very often. In fact, in the movies that I made, you see them a little too much because I always had to, you know, I have to compromise to some degree with the needs of an audience, but it's even more difficult to see them.
In real life, the tendency
in a movie is to bring somebody who's firing at you a little closer to camera so that you can at least see some outlines. In real life, it was probably more invisible and dirtier and even more surprising. And death is even worse than it is on the screen. I mean, death is so, you know, it's pretty ugly and it smells bad too. I got Dale Dye to work with me. He's an ex-Marine, and he was real helpful. You know, we'd walk the terrain, and you basically plot it out, do your homework. But we kept it spontaneous. We had a terrific cameraman, Bob Richardson. We had some great Steadicam operating. We did Bourne. We did completely different than Platoon.
What were the differences?
I wanted to go with a beach. I wanted to go with a yellow, blinding sky because I worked up in the 1st Cav, up in the beach areas in the North 1st Corps. And I remember patrolling those beaches, and there were little dangers there that you don't get in the jungle. And the sense of the sun, it reminded me of Camus' Stranger, and that Kovic would lose it, you know. He would just lose it in the sun and shoot his own man, you know, because he'd be blinded by the sunspots and sort of the panic, that crazy intent. You know, you don't, when the bullet flies, the human beings all respond the same. The eyes tighten. The brains kind of go dead a little bit. You don't think that much, you know, when you're under fire. So we tried to do Bourne real different than Platoon because people had seen a lot of the jungles. I think that's one of the things I'm real proud of in Bourne is the ocean and the beach and the village.
Is there any one story that you would always tell the actors who you worked with in those movies about what the war was like?
No, we put them through training. And
right.
It was important that they not sleep. I remember in Platoon, and we put them through 12 days with Dye up in the Philippine bush. And I really insisted. I said, I don't want this well-slept look that I see in war movies. I want these guys to look tired and beaten. And you can't fake that for some reason. You can't put makeup under their eyes. You got to give them a sense of what it's like not to sleep for a year. You don't sleep in Nam. You get three hours if you're lucky. And 2 hours here, but you're always sleeping with radar on. So that's where you get that kind of vacant look. So we put him in the bush, and we worked him around the clock. We made him, you know, pull guard duty and sentry duty all night, and they came out. They were so angry and irritable. That's the irritability of infantry all over the world at any time. It's a given. And I think we caught that, and the guys got it. But you can never teach an actor exactly what it's like, you know. But they are very imaginative actors, and they are able to cross that gulf and imagine, but there's no substitute for actually being there.
So that's how you work with them, really irritable, without sleep.
And yeah, you gotta. It's not an easy film to make. You know, you're pushing the actors, you're pushing the crew. You're getting into a state where there's a lot of tension.
When you got back to the States from the war, just a few days after you got back, you were busted on marijuana possession charges. I think trying to cross the border into Mexico. And the story that I read is that your father spent about $2,500 in payoffs to get you out of prison. Is that the right story?
Yeah, I was coming back from Mexico. I wasn't going to.
Oh, I see.
I was carrying about an ounce of grass, you know, and Nixon's border war was going on. And they were more concerned about getting the underclass of young kids than they were about ending the war in Vietnam, I think. It was an interesting experience for me because I was about 8 days out of the NAM. 8 days, and I get thrown into a San Diego federal county. It was a county jail, but it was a federal charge. And I think there was like room for 2,000 to 3,000 prisoners. There was about 10,000, 12,000 kids in there. And I really got my eyes open because I just come from like fighting with the whole underclass in NAM, and then coming over to a prison and just seeing the other side of the coin. It was like the war was at home. It was, you know, it was real clear to me that something was wrong with our system, where we're imprisoning the young and then at the same time sending them over to Vietnam. I could see where that gap was developing that Morrison was talking about, 5 to 1, 1 in 5, no one here gets out alive, you know. We want it. We want the world. We want it now, you know. That kind of emotion was coming through that period in the late 60s. Revolution was being talked about. It was a radical time, you know. And that prison was ugly. Yeah, I mean, those kids, Nixon really cracked down on hallucinogenics and marijuana because he was threatened by that freedom. He was threatened by a lot of things. And he was busy bombing Cambodia and Laos, you know, and putting kids in jail. And those kids, if they didn't have any money, you know, it was a tough system. You went up, you didn't get any public aid, and except for 6 months later, they'd show up, the lawyers show up, you'd go in front of the judge. And as often as not, I was facing 5 years to 20 years. And I basically bought my way out with my father's money. Bought my way out. My interest, my records disappeared. The lawyer came and the public aid guy and got me out. But I think he did pay off some buddies.
What did you owe your father for that?
What I owe him?
Well, emotionally.
Well, I think that started the whole war at home. You know, because I don't think that he ever understood what we had been through over there. Mm-hmm. To him, it was a police action. That's what he described it to me as when I got home, you know. Sort of like the Korea War, a police action, but call it what you want, you know. When you're in a firefight, the degree of attrition in Vietnam was very high with that modern weaponry. An AK-47 can take out a half a unit in no time at all. I mean, the guys I in the 25th Infantry, most of the guys I served with from September to January 68 were either killed or evacuated or wounded. You know, it was serious business out there. And I don't think my father understood the degree of intensity in that war. It kind of crept up on us, Vietnam, you know. Now all of a sudden there's a recognition that 55,000 were killed and whatever, 200,000 badly wounded, and another 200,000 are probably mentally destroyed from having fought it. So you're getting up into some pretty big numbers there.
Screenwriter and director Oliver Stone. We'll continue our conversation on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
5 to 1, baby. 1 in 5. No one here gets out alive now.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The 1971 film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song is considered the movie that paved the way for blaxploitation films. And the success of the director, screenwriter, and producer Melvin Van Peebles helped open the door to other black filmmakers. Coming up, we meet Melvin Van Peebles. He's just directed a new film starring his son Mario. And book critic John Leonard considers how mystery writers fare when they leave their own turf. He has reviews of new books by Tony Hillerman and Andrew Vox. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The 2+4 group, along with Poland, have now reached an important agreement, confirming Poland's border with East Germany and clearing the way for a unified Germany by the end of the year. In another important move announced today in Paris, West Germany agreed to hold economic talks with Poland later this summer.
Several Soviet communist leaders...
Meanwhile, in Moscow, there is talk of a coalition government. A Soviet official has said that non-communists could soon be included in the Soviet government. Tim Hewell of the BBC reports from Moscow.
Including Mr. Gorbachev, have talked of the need for the party to work with other forces. But until now, none has raised the possibility of a coalition, a chief demand of the large opposition demonstration in Moscow 3 days ago. In his interview with the BBC, however, Mr. Bakatin said a form of power-sharing would now be a logical development. Bakatin, who is 52, is one of the younger and more liberal members of the inner leadership. Like other top leaders, his main power base is now the presidential council, rather than any party body. But even so, he's worried by increasing demands for the complete depoliticization of the army and police, which he sees as part of the growing wave of anti-communism sweeping the Soviet Union.
Tim Hewell of the BBC reporting from Moscow. The streets are now calm in the East African nation of Kenya, but the battle between pro-democracy supporters and the nation's ruling party leaders continues, this time with words. NPR's Dan Zwerdling reports from Nairobi.
The latest skirmish erupted Sunday when an influential Anglican bishop named Henry Okulu called for President Daniel Arap Moi's government to resign. Religious leaders have been pushing for a more democratic political system in recent months, but Okulu's statement was the strongest yet. He blamed government leaders for causing last week's riots by engaging in widespread corruption and election fraud, and by failing to solve the nation's economic problems. Yesterday, ruling party officials called for the government to put the bishop in jail, and one top cabinet official, President Moi's Minister of Commerce, told the public they should arm themselves with machetes and slash anybody who calls for a multi-party system. A government statement issued later said the courts, not vigilantes, should punish criminals, but the mild statement did not rebuke the minister for his comments. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Nairobi.
In this country, Washington has promised $3 million to help Libya fight a deadly fly that is a potential threat to both wildlife and livestock in much of Africa. UN officials say, though, that a fundraising effort is far short of the money needed to carry out the program. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed unchanged at 2,999.75 on volume of some 179 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Melvin Van Peebles was one of the first black feature filmmakers. He wrote, directed, scored, produced, and starred in the 1971 action film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. It remains one of the highest-grossing independent features of all time. Although the film's success helped open the door to Hollywood for other black filmmakers, Van Peebles never quite walked through that door himself. He directed only one Hollywood movie, the 1969 Watermelon Man. After Sweetback, Van Peebles left filmmaking, produced two Broadway shows, wrote for television, worked as a Wall Street trader, and wrote a book about stock options. In January, Robert Redford's Sundance Institute had a tribute to Melvin Van Peebles. And last month, the Museum of Modern Art in New York showed a retrospective of his work, including his new film, Identity Crisis. Van Peebles directed and produced Identity Crisis. His son Mario wrote the screenplay and stars in the film. It was Mario that helped get his father back into movies.
Really, Mario kept urging me, come on, Dad, I really would like us to do something together again, because he had worked with me on some of my Broadway shows. He had been an actor in some of them, and he'd always worked around me from, you know, from earliest childhood. In fact, he was in the infamous opening scene of Sweetback.
Yes, well, since you brought that up, I'll ask you about that scene. Sweetback, the movie opens with a 10-year-old Sweetback finding a home for himself in a whorehouse and having his sexual initiation with a 40-year-old woman. And it's a fairly explicitly done scene. They're both nude. He's in between her legs. And this is your son in that role, your 10-year-old son. I was astonished when I found out it was your son. What made you decide to cast him in that part?
Well, one, he tends to look like me, being my
right.
son and all.
Yeah.
And what I always found very interesting was people saying, but it's your son. But every child is someone's son, and I wouldn't ask my son or myself to do anything that I wouldn't ask of anyone else's child. I don't have that differentiation of, well, it's mine, and therefore it cannot be.
Let me just ask you, how much did your son know about sex when that scene was shot? I mean, did he get what was happening?
Well, let me put it this way. He wanted a bicycle for Christmas, so he didn't have a lot of leverage. And I didn't ask him, actually. Well, he did say something rather funny, though. He said, Dad, is this going to be an X movie? I said, yes. He said, phew. Oh, I don't want the kids at the school to see me.
Uh-huh. Your film, Sweetback, was considered to be the first of the blaxploitation films. What you did was you took the action genre and put it into a black politicized context. And I'd really be interested in hearing what gave you the idea to do that.
Well, being alive really gave me the idea of doing it. I just got my original reason for going into films was that I had gotten tired of seeing blacks portrayed in an image that I didn't agree with. And so I said, gee, I can do better than that. And that had been, 15 years earlier when I had made that decision. I didn't mean technically. That hadn't interested me. It was simply the content. And if you don't control your images, then you don't have a base for controlling your destiny. So I wanted to control how I was perceived, and therefore I went into films. Now, you said something very interesting when you said that the film was the first blaxploitation film. It was not really the blaxploitation film. It started blaxploitation, which took out the political content and just kept the action and the winning black person. In fact, the revolutionary aspect of Sweetback was put at a 180-degree turn and became almost an apology for the man. For example, what I mean by that is Sweetback had a political education. This person who was essentially apolitical, as he was running from a situation that he always had avoided, he discovered that all of the lines in the community were controlled by a larger power structure, and that power structure was coming down on him like a ton of bricks. And therefore, what he had avoided, that knowledge that he had avoided, he was confronted with. And rather than acquiesce to that situation, he charged forward. The movies that came afterwards, because up until that time, there had really been no black movies that mirrored the ethos, the wants and the desires of the lumpen proletariat, the urban proletariat. And that's what Sweetback did. However, what they did afterwards is they took someone like the detectives, who, if you really analyze it very carefully, was always under the thumb of an urban buana. That is, he had Shaft had the commissioner to report to, even though he was permitted to be a slightly freelance, slightly freewheeling, which was the sop that was thrown to the black audience. The Cleopatra Jones series, there again you had someone who was working for the government as an undercover agent. In each case, these people became an apology for the system.
Well, you're talking about wanting to make movies that had an image that you believed in. Now, Sweetback was praised by a lot of people for being a black film, you know, made by blacks, starring blacks, set in the black community. On the other hand, it was criticized by many people within the black community for having its hero be the real stud. And some people saw that as perpetuating a stereotype instead of shattering it. And I wonder what you thought of those criticisms and what you think of them now in retrospect.
Well, I thought that Jesus Christ was nothing but a carpenter in his own hometown, and so it really didn't bother me too much. I think that's completely valid, what they said, and I disagree with it 100%. That is, you can take a stereotype and you don't have to run from it. You can take it to the other side and throw it back a la jiu-jitsu and use that stereotype as the impetus for your force. You see, I could have taken Sweetback and had him a college professor, but that was not the situation of the people that I wanted to talk to, the larger group of people that I wanted to talk to. I took Sweetback from, let's say, one of the lowest possible common denominators in the community and therefore moved him forward. I didn't move him forward from some elevated period or position in the community from the first place, whereas the people once again left out in the cold. It wasn't somebody that they knew. That's why I felt that the audience reacted so positively, the major audience, much of the intelligentsia or many of the cultural nationalists did not like that move. Well, that is a valid point of view. It doesn't happen to be my own.
How come you cast yourself in the starring role?
Well, a number of reasons. First, I needed someone with a large understanding of cinema who had a number of years of experience in it, and the people that had that number of years of experience in the cinema generally were not of the street ilk that I needed, one. Two, those that were wanted him to have more lines. He said 6 lines in the whole movie. And they had been taught that lines equal a size of film, a size of a part. Do you follow me?
Mm-hmm, sure do.
And I didn't want him to talk a lot. He didn't have to talk a lot. And that's why I did it.
There were a couple of weeks when Sweetback outdid Love Story at the box office, which is pretty extraordinary considering it was an independently produced film. How did you independently get that kind of distribution?
Well, I didn't independently get that kind of distribution. What I simply did was make a good movie. Only 2 theaters in the United States would show it. 2 theaters at all would show the movie. And they did so well, then everybody called me. And at that stage of the game, hey, it was their turn in the barrel. I made deals, and the audience went to see it. That's how that happened.
Melvin Van Peebles is my guest. This is a scene from Sweetback. It's from the beginning of the film when 2 white cops are investigating black clubs and homes looking for a murder suspect.
We don't know nothing about no dead man.
We know that, but the commissioner doesn't. We just want to borrow one of your boys for a couple hours and take him downtown to make us look good, official-wise.
Why me? I'm sure one man already. George is sick.
You're our friend. We knew you'd be willing to lend a hand.
When did you people start getting so interested in black folks? Dead or alive?
Progress.
More from screenwriter, director, and producer Melvin Van Peebles after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Melvin Van Peebles is my guest. His films include Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song and Watermelon Man. He directed and produced a new film called Identity Crisis that stars and was written by his son, Mario. You were one of the first, or perhaps the first, black director of a feature film, feature-length film.
Well, I was probably the first of a commercial feature film outside of... after Oscar Michaud went out of business in around 1932 with the with the advent of sound, he had to phase out.
Were his movies feature length?
Yes, he did a number of feature length movies.
Okay,
I came back to the States in 1967 as one of the French delegates to the San Francisco Film Festival. No one knew I was an American, let alone black, and. I had lived in Europe for many years, and I was a French journalist and then writer, and there was a law that a French writer can have a director's card to direct his own work. So one of my novels I turned into a film script, and that's how I got a French director's card, and that's how the film was made in France.
So you started your film career in France.
I didn't start my film
career. Well, you started making movies.
I didn't start making movies in France. I made movies in San Francisco when I used to drive a cable car many years ago.
Oh, I see. So you'd made like small, short, independent films.
I made short, independent films, and I went to Hollywood with my films, and I said, here are my films, here's some of my work, I've written the story, etc., and I'd like a job. And they offered me a job as an elevator operator. I said, no, you don't understand. I like to write. I like to direct. Then they offered me a job as a tap dancer or a dancer. You know, I said, hey, guys, that's not what I had in mind. And then they explained to me that one day my people might learn to operate this complicated equipment, et cetera, et cetera. And the rainfall at Kilimanjaro was this, that, and the other, you know. And I was at that juncture. I left America.
And you went to France.
No, I went to Holland to get my PhD in astronomy. I used to be an astronomer. And however, those early first films I made were seen in France. Henri Langlois, who started really the first cinema museum, the Cinémathèque Française, declared me a genius and looked me up. And I was living in Holland at the time and said I should be making films. Well, once he called me a genius, I said, finally, there's somebody who understands me.
So you don't think it would have been possible to start your career as a director had you just stayed in America?
What do I know? I mean, it didn't seem that it was burgeoning with opportunity at the time.
Uh-huh. You only made one movie through a studio, and that was Watermelon Man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did that go from your perspective?
Well, it was the most difficult movie I probably had to make, because half the time was spent in the corridors of power placating the nervous executives. It was actually the first feature film made by a black in Hollywood itself, and that was one of the stipulations that I had, that we make it in Hollywood. So, and that we use a crew of disenfranchised, which meant women, which meant Orientals or Mexicans, blacks, et cetera, et cetera. None of these people really were around at the time. Each union had one person they would trot out, but outside of that, there really, really wasn't a fair share, which there still isn't today, even though it is seemingly a little better. A fair share of representation of the disenfranchised. And so I got them on as apprentices. And most of those people have gone on to rather good positions in the film community.
You ended up leaving movies to work on Wall Street. Are you still working on Wall Street now?
No, I don't work on Wall Street because it's time intensive. And that is, you have to spend, you don't get a chance to go to the bathroom from when the bell goes off until it goes back off in the evening, when it goes off at 9 in the morning or 8:30 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. And I just found that too exhausting to do that and continue with my other work at the same time.
You were probably, when you started on Wall Street, one of the few black traders with a seat on the exchange.
I was the only black trader on the American Stock Exchange. at the time I started there. There were a number, there were, I think, five brokers. Now, a broker is different than a trader. A broker works on the commission and he execute orders for others. A trader executes from his own, for his account or his own company's account, and he does not work on a commission.
So what was it like being the only black trader on the exchange?
Well, I've been in a number of other situations. I was the first black Eagle Scout in the Pohegan Trails. I was the first first black navigator in my squadron. I was the first black and out of ROTC in my college. You know, on and on and on and on, and again. It was not particularly disconcerting to me.
Do you feel that the film industry is any more receptive to black actors, black producers, than the film industry was when you got started?
I think they've become aware of the financial potential and therefore are more willing to use. I mean, if that means as of a change of heart, I don't think there's probably a change of heart. I just think that if you can show that something can make money, the reason there was this rash of blaxploitation movies after Sweetback was is because it made a lot of money. The man has an Achilles pocketbook. If you can show him that he can make money, he'll go with it. He'll find the moral or the correct reason later to justify it.
In your new book, No Identity Crisis, your son Mario, with tongue-in-cheek, calls you his lizard dad.
Right.
It talks about you as being the person who really lacks diplomacy when it comes to dealing with somebody.
I gave it the office. My diplomacy was worn away a few years ago. Well, a long time ago.
Did you ever have any?
I can't remember back that far. That's very unfair. How do I know? As I look back, I don't think that was one of my strong points. That was one of my strong points, diplomacy.
Filmmaker Melvin Van Peebles. Melvin and his son Mario co-authored a new book about the making of their new film, Identity Crisis. The book is called No Identity Crisis. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. The 2+4 talks have concluded in Paris. That's a conference between the four victorious Allied powers and the two Germanys on German unity. The principal barrier to German unity that remained at these talks was the borders with Poland and Poland's demands that that issue be settled before unity. Poland has given way, and German unity marches on. We'll have a number of pieces about that. We're going to talk about the oil lake that is growing under Brooklyn. And Bob Garfield has a piece for us on piercing, not just ears either.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our book critic John Leonard recently read two new mysteries. One is Blossom by Andrew Vox, who usually writes about the violence and perversity of the big city. The other is Coyote Waits by Tony Hillerman, who usually sets his novels in the Southwest. Occasionally, both authors wander, but John says their fiction works best when it sticks close to home.
In his last mystery novel, Tony Hillerman left home for the first time and took both of his Indian detectives with him. Jim Chee and Joe Leaphorn ended up in Washington, D.C., at the Smithsonian, where some of the old dead bones actually belong to white people. I liked Talking God a lot, but I'm glad that in Coyote Waits, Chi and Leaphorn are back where they belong. I missed the desert and the mountains of Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico, the weather and the ghosts, the sand painting and the skinwalking and the Navajo shamanism. I depend on Hillerman to steep me in the severities of landscape and the mysteries of culture. When in Coyote Waits, tribal policeman Delbert Nez dies a fiery death, pursuing a graffiti artist in a black basalt volcanic throat, and poor Ashy Pinto with his crystals is arrested for the crime, and Janet Pete comes back to Albuquerque to complicate Jim Chi's love life, and Joe Leaphorn meets a female anthropologist he may want to take with him from Flagstaff to China, I'm as happy as a fly on the wall in the dance hall of the dead. This time around, we've not only got the FBI we've learned to despise from previous Hillerman novels, but some Vietnamese war criminals, too, not to mention graduate students who hate their professors, and the surprise truth about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It's once more into the altogether agreeable dream world of Changing Woman, the Salt People, Bitter Waters, Turquoise Mountain, and the Mud Clan. As usual, Leaphorn deduces and Chi intuits. Coyote, the enemy of law and harmony, is a metaphor for chaos. The pattern, like the pattern of the drops when rain is falling, depends on where you stand. Hillerman doesn't so much mystify as he enchants. On the other hand, in Blossom, the latest mystery by Andrew Vox, I wish tough guy Burke had stayed home in New York. What's Burke doing in Indiana, without his adopted outlaw family? Max, the Mongolian deaf-mute and martial arts expert. Mole, the antisocial Nazi-hating electronics genius. And Dr. Pablo, the Harvard Med School Puerto Rican terrorist. Legless Prophet shows up for a couple of pages, but Michelle the transsexual has gone for a sex change operation. This leaves Burke on his own, in the woods, trying to quit cigarettes while looking for a sexually perverted sniper who kills kids in the local lover's lane. It's a debt of honor Burke owes an old friend from prison days, but it's also, of course, an aspect of what he calls his dark zen, that territory of himself he invades on his crusade as the avenging father of all the lost children, the busted-up babies, burned, beaten, crippled, sexually abused. It's not that I doubt Vox, a juvenile justice lawyer himself when he isn't writing savage novels. I'm sure just as much of this stuff goes on in Indiana as in New York. But I count on Burke to wise me up about the city I live in. Who else would know that so few $5 bills are in circulation among straight citizens in New York because of crack? I hadn't known this. I need to know more. Anyway, Blossom, the latest heroine to give her name to a Vox novel, makes Burke use a condom. This, to my knowledge, is a first, the very first, in mystery fiction.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Blossom by Andrew Vox and Coyote Waits by Tony Hillerman. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shura. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our conversation with screenwriter and director Oliver Stone. His films include Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, Salvador, and Wall Street. And we meet two musicians with the French band Les Negresses Vertes. The band mixes French song with North African and gypsy music. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.